all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Three. Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. And our guest today is Helen Thorpe. She's an author. One of her more recent books is Soldier Girls, The Battle of Three Women at Home and at War. Helen, say hello to the Veteran Radio listening audience.
Hello, it's wonderful to be with you today. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, Helen, this is a really interesting book. Let me set it up a little bit for our listeners. It's the story of three women from the Indiana Army National Guard Bravo Company, the 113th Support Battalion of the 76th Infantry Brigade. We won't go through all that again. We'll just say they're with the Indiana Army National Guard. In the period of time you cover with these three women is about 2001 through, 2013, 14? Where does it sort of stop?
You know, the paperback came out recently, and that has an afterword that brings the reader up to date all the way through 2015. And in the hardback, it stops around 2013.
Well, it's very interesting, listeners, and I really encourage you to go out and get Soldier Girls, The Battle of Three Women at Home and at War, because it takes these three soldiers from pre-9/11 to Afghanistan, back home, and then off to a second deployment to Iraq and back home. So you get a real intimate look at the pre-deployment, deployment, and post-deployment issues that these three women face in the Army National Guard. Helen, tell us a little bit about yourself. Let's give the listeners an understanding of who Helen Thorpe is as a author.
Sure. And then I want to come back to what you just mentioned about these three women all enlisting before 9/11. So let's not forget to do that.
Sure.
My background, I have been a journalist my whole adult life. I started off, working as an intern for free at the Boston Phoenix many, many years ago, and waitressing to pay the rent at the same time. And after that, I got a staff job at another weekly newspaper called the New York Observer. And then I started writing for magazines, and eventually about 10 years ago began writing books. And I have really loved each phase of my career, but writing books is definitely the phase that suits me the best, and I love it the most. I feel very lucky to be doing it.
Well, let's talk about these three women who enlisted and a little bit about maybe why you found them, how you found them, and a little bit about why they were attractive to you to be subjects of a pretty in-depth effort here.
Yeah. So I think that our society is really divided between the civilian side of the equation and the military side. And I feel that the cultures have become very separate over time, as you've had many military families through generations with many, you'll have a son and a father and a grandfather and a daughter as well, all serving in the military over different generations. And you get a very distinct military culture there. And then on the civilian side, which is the side that I live in and I inhabit and I know, we don't have the firsthand experience of going on a deployment. We don't know what that means in a personal way. We're sort of distant from the sacrifices that military families make. We don't fully understand them, I feel. And so I really wanted to write a book that would somehow be an attempt to bridge that divide. And what I was thinking about was, could I explain some important things about military culture and what people who serve in the military go through to civilians who might otherwise not really appreciate or understand what the military does for them, for our country. And so when I first met Michelle, who's kind of the main character of the book. She's a young woman who enlists in the National Guard for just one reason only. She really wants to go to college, a great college, and she absolutely cannot figure out how to pay for her college tuition. So she sees the military as the answer, a way out of the circumstances that she's in. It's like a lifeline for her. At the same time, her decision to enlist is a little complicated because she's a lefty liberal. She's just voted for Ralph Nader. She knows she's not going to fit in well in the military culture. She's a little afraid even of enlisting and what will the experience be like. It's not something she's like wildly excited about. She's doing it out of more need, I think, and hope.
And Michelle's the one of the three that does have a family history of service in the military.
Yeah, and Debbie also, yeah. So Debbie and Michelle both come from families that have that history. So Michelle's father was in the military. He was serving in the Army during Vietnam, and her uncle served during Vietnam, and her grandfather served during World War II. And Debbie, who I haven't really described yet, Debbie's actually 30 years older than Michelle. Her father was a drill sergeant, and Debbie thinks of herself as a daddy's girl and really wants to enlist to follow in her father's footsteps. She's also deeply patriotic. She loves guns. She got a rifle when she was in high school, and it was, you know, her greatest joy during high school was going down to a quarry in the afternoon with a bunch of guys that she was friends with and out shooting them all. They were shooting, you know, plastic milk cartons that they would throw into the quarry, and they would shoot them till they sank. And she used to outshoot the boys, and Debbie just thought that was awesome. And Desma is the one person whose family doesn't have the same military history. Desma is between Michelle and Debbie in age. She's a single mom with three children. She's had a rough life. She grew up partly in the foster care system. And for her, the military offered structure, an extra paycheck, but also just a sense of organization. Her life can sometimes be disorderly or chaotic, and the military really helps her acquire discipline, I would say.
So they all come to it with a slightly different maybe reason for enlisting, but
for sure.
But certainly the extra paycheck or the benefits,
yeah,
comes across in your book as a soldier girls as a driver for these three women to join the Indiana National Guard. But when they did so, their expectations of what that meant maybe was not what it turned out to be. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Sure. What I love about having three women to write about, and you know, these three women in real life are very, very distinct from one another, and I think of them as running the gamut or covering a spectrum of beliefs. You know, on the one hand, you have Michelle, very left-leaning. You have Desma, who voted for Bush right before she enlisted, or right before 9/11 happened. And then you have Debbie, who never votes because she doesn't like politicians. So I see them as having very distinct beliefs and very distinct responses to joining. Their differences are kind of what intrigued me. I really enjoyed getting to know them and seeing how different they were. I actually believe that they might not ever have become friends except that they went on overseas deployments together. And that then forged a bond so strong that today they'll say they're like family. But they're still quite different from one another. They often don't agree on things. And I loved that. I loved that they didn't agree. Because that way, in the book, you could present different points of view on similar things, if that makes sense.
You were able to, Helen, look at and talk with these three women and a lot of their friends and family members. I mean, we get a deep dive into sort of not only what their personal life, but their financial life, their issues with guys and kids and and drinking and drugs. All of that shows up both in their pre-deployment, deployment, and post-deployment lives.
Yeah.
How did you get that deep into these three people's and their friends' lives?
You know, I have been inspired by some other books that I really love that are similar in the sense of they're works of narrative nonfiction. They're written like novels, but they're nonfiction books that are heavily reported and have a lot of documentary evidence to support everything. But when you read them, you feel like you're reading a novel. You're kind of swept along by getting to know the characters really well. So when I was spending time with these women, I asked them, first of all, we did, you know, a couple of years worth of interviews. I mean, they spent so much time with me, not only explaining themselves and their personal lives, but their experience of military culture, what it felt like and looked like, and what it signified to them. So in addition to those interviews, I also asked them, you know, did they have any material they could share with me that would kind of help us refresh their memories and also back up what they were saying. So they shared their military records. And Desma, when she returned home from her second deployment, she came home with an injury and with post-traumatic stress. So she shared also, and she actually volunteered this. I didn't ask to see it because it is deeply personal, but she turned over her entire medical record with all of her therapy notes in it. And that was, for me, a huge window onto what it means to try to grapple with PTSD, and I learned a huge amount from that. Michelle had letters that she wrote to her father and her boyfriend that she shared, and those were real incredible descriptions of her time on the post in Afghanistan, Camp Phoenix, where they were stationed in Kabul, real snapshot into what she was thinking at that time. And Debbie, of course, had kept 6 diaries, and when she shared those with me, I was elated because she wrote almost every day. And so, it gave a perfect sort of chronology of events. If they mentioned something in an interview and I wondered when that had happened and they couldn't remember, I could just look in Debbie's diary and there it would be.
So, well, before we get to Afghanistan and Camp Phoenix, tell us a little bit about the jobs that these three women had in the military.
Sure.
Those veterans would recognize it as their MOS.
Yeah.
But just let's talk about it in terms of their jobs.
Sure, I will. And you can correct me when I get the terminology wrong because I'm still a newbie at all the acronyms. But yes, so Michelle, when she first enlisted and was figuring out what her job would be, or her MOS, which I think stands for Military Occupational Specialty, and I had to learn that
it
one.
Does.
I didn't know it going
does.
In.
It does.
She chose to be a weapons mechanic, which is really interesting because she's kind of a peacenik, and why would she want to work with weapons if she, you know, is sort of afraid of them and is not sure about how she feels about firing a gun? But Michelle was thinking of it this way, you know, when she was enlisting in the Guard, where she lived geographically, there was a heavy concentration of infantry in that area. Essentially, you know, her local unit and anything nearby was an infantry unit. So she can't be in the infantry because she's female, and what at that point in time that was the way things were. And what she can do is serve in a support capacity. And out of all the support jobs available, doing laundry, cooking, field sanitation, you know, they're not so appealing to her. She didn't want to drive a truck because she thought that gets you into dangerous situations. You're out in difficult spots close to combat. She would prefer to stay on post if possible. So she chose weapons mechanic. Debbie, 30 years older than Michelle, been in the Guard a lot longer, loves guns. Debbie chose weapons mechanic too, but for all the opposite reasons. She just wanted to work with guns because she thought they were really exciting, really cool. And, you know, I love Debbie as the character because she's a grandmother. She's older than all the other characters in the book. She's works as a beautician in her civilian life. and yet, you know, she loves guns. And I just love that contradiction in her character. We don't necessarily think of grandmothers as being somebody who wants to go down to the firing range and see if they can shoot a perfect score, but that's who Debbie is. She's a pretty amazing person. Desna had a different MOS. She opted to go for supply and logistics. Desma's thinking was she figured if she could do supply and logistics in the military, those job skills might translate into the civilian world. So she saw it as a way to educate herself and get some skills that would be useful to her all her life.
And one of the things, again, that sort of separates these three women is their, not their native intelligence, but sort of their, because they're all real smart in their own way.
Yep.
But instead sort of what they hope, sort of what, where they see the arc of their life going.
Right.
And Michelle, who's, yeah, Michelle, who's very smart, I don't know that I made the note, but did like 34 on her ACT, for those who care, is really looking to make her way into college.
Right.
Whereas you say Desma's looking for something that will help her advance in the civilian work world.
Yeah. Desma dropped out of high school. She did complete her GED, but she never got a college degree. She tried college at the community college level briefly and just wasn't a good fit. She got in a fight with a professor. He gave her an F. She quit. And that's kind of, that's typical of Desma at that point in her life to run into those sort of difficulties and maybe decide to pack it in. So Michelle, on the other hand, you know, you see her in the course of the book fulfill her dream of getting the college degree that she wants with her military benefits. And she is the most educated out of the three women, and she is the one who's aiming for a professional career, maybe like a white-collar job. Yeah.
And so we're in early, mid, maybe 2004, and the unit gets activated, this time for real. There had been a sort of a false alarm earlier in the book, but this time they get activated and they're heading to Afghanistan. Walk us through the reaction of the women as they actually find themselves heading over to a foreign land, foreign culture for the first time.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because their reactions are so different, and again, they run the gamut. So on the one hand, Michelle is just horrified, and in fact, she is so reluctant to fulfill her commitment and actually go on the deployment that, you know, at first she sort of dreams of these crazy ways that she could maybe get out of the deployment. Like, she says, what if she were to deliberately break her own leg? Or what if she got tattoos on her hands? Or what if she married her best friend, Rachel, and said she was gay and therefore she couldn't actually serve in the military after all? She's trying to think of ways she can get herself kicked out of the unit. And she doesn't act on any of those. They're just like crazy schemes that she thinks about in the fear, in the moment of fear when she gets her deployment orders. But she's basically really scared and really reluctant and really upset about leaving her boyfriend and having to drop out of college for a period of time to fulfill the deployment orders. And then Desma is totally taken aback because the deployment orders come and there's very little time. It's just a matter of weeks before they have to go on active duty status and start mobilizing. And with three kids, Desma has to scramble to figure out who's going to take care of her children. Previously, Desma had been married, but she's gotten a divorce now, and she's not on great terms with her ex-husband, and is not thinking that he's going to take the children. So her two daughters wind up staying with a cousin, first cousin of Desma's that she's very close to, and her son goes to stay with his father. So, and he's from a previous relationship. So that's how Desma sort of scrambles. I mean, Desma doesn't even have time to let herself feel scared or worried or reluctant. She's too busy trying to figure out how to take care of her children and fulfill the deployment orders. And then you have Debbie, who is told that she's going to stay back and is actually really upset because she wants to go. She feels serving on an overseas deployment would be the highlight of her entire life. And she desperately does not want to be left behind when everybody else that she knows and is close to goes off and has this, what she is thinking of almost as a very difficult adventure or a quest or something like that. So she is like, how can I get on the deployment? And actually, she asks other people if she can go in their place. You know, there's a friend who's a man who's expecting a his wife is expecting a baby, and Debbie's like, don't you want to stay home with your baby? I could go for you. And you actually see somebody get injured, and then the leaders of their unit think, well, we better ask Debbie because she's been agitating to go to take his place. And she does finally get to go with everybody, and she is just ecstatic. She writes in her diary, I know nobody will understand, but I'm a happy camper.
And I think those of us who've been in the military, and certainly many people we've talked to on Veterans Radio, have experienced all of those emotions in different deployments, or have know a buddy or a friend who fits one of those categories. And that's what I think so interesting about this book. Listeners, we're talking to Helen Thorpe. The book is Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. These are three women from the Indiana Army National Guard. They get to Afghanistan. As I say, everything's different from the food, the work, the boredom, the uniqueness of it. But all three of these women are in a support role.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about how they felt being inside the wire.
Sure. And I want to just make clear again that they all enlisted before 9/11, and so they did not see overseas deployments coming. And as members of the National Guard, they didn't anticipate active duty status. It wasn't something they had planned for. Or in Michelle's case, she hadn't even really thought about it. She didn't even think that was possible for her to get deployed. I mean, of course it was, but she had really enlisted thinking college tuition benefits, not imagining wartime. So in Afghanistan, all three women were, as you are mentioning, in support roles, and they were supposed to stay inside the wire, although pretty quickly Michelle and Debbie start going off post. I think, you know, as support personnel living on the post who had not imagined active duty, never dreamt of being close to combat, they felt reassured staying inside the wire. I don't think they felt shame about it the way somebody might if they were aspiring to really be where the fight is. But in Debbie's case, you know, she did think that it was important, for example, that she not take a vacation, that she not take leave, because she thought, well, if she took leave, then somebody else who might be operating in a combat role, you know, might not get to take their leave. Like, she wanted to make sure that she never left during her entire deployment, never went anywhere else, so that she could stay in the support role and make sure her unit was well supported. So she felt, I think, a deep obligation to support those who are going outside the wire. Interestingly, Michelle and Debbie, they were on the armament team, and there just were not – the American weapons were so high-functioning that they were not being broken on a regular basis, so they didn't have a ton of weapons to fix. And they were actually approached – their team was approached and asked, would they please work on AK-47s that were going to be given – to the Afghan National Army. So then they did start going outside the wire and traveling off post to go work on the AKs. And so Debbie, again, just thought this was so interesting to work on Soviet weaponry. She thought it was a chance of a lifetime how many American weapons mechanics get to work on AK-47s. She was thrilled. Michelle, on the other hand, was also thrilled, but for totally different reasons. She liked going off post because she got to experience the culture of Afghanistan, and she fell in love with the country.
once again, there's this sort of difference. The beauty of having three subjects here to write about is they experience the same thing, but approach it from a different view. Listeners, we're talking to Helen Thorpe, who's the author of Soldier Girls. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back to pick up the story about these three women in Afghanistan, and then a second deployment for two of them in Iraq in 2008. And welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're talking to author Helen Thorpe, who wrote Soldier Girls, The Battle of Three Women at Home and at War. These are three women who enlisted in the Indiana Army National Guard pre-9/11 and find themselves deployed to Afghanistan. The book is very interesting, Helen, in terms of walking through both the humdrum and the efforts to combat that, along with the excitement of being in the deployment. But I want to talk about two instances so that we have some time for some other things. One deals with what happens, how their views get molded, because it wasn't until quite a number of months later, I think it's March of 2005, when a roadside mine kills four from their unit or near their unit, and that's the first killed in action that they experienced. Tell us a little bit about how the women reacted to that.
So, the four soldiers who were killed in that incident, they belonged to another unit in the same brigade of the Indiana Guard, and the three women felt very much as though they had lost members of their family, was how they thought about it, even though they weren't in the same unit and they didn't do exactly the same sort of work. But they did know some of the guys personally. Desma had sort of fond memories of one of the men who was a volunteer firefighter in his civilian life, who was coming through on fire checks and would come through their tent and, you know, tell her to take down the blanket she'd hung up as a curtain and all her little violations of safety. And she thought he was just an excellent guy and had really admired him. But all three of them felt very strongly a huge sense of loss. And Debbie, who is such a team player and relates so closely to everybody else who wears a uniform, really took it the hardest. And she ended up needing to go to Mass to try to settle herself. And the question she found on her mind as she was sitting in Mass was, why couldn't it have been me? She thought if she could have died instead, it would have been somehow better or more fair, because the guys who died were so young. And they had families, they had children, young children at home, whereas her daughter was fully grown. And Debbie thought it would have been, like, in her mind she was imagining maybe even, like, a better use of resources if somebody had chosen to have her be in that vehicle. It's a little bit kind of a curious response maybe, but I can well imagine having it myself. I'm sure, you know, other soldiers might feel the same when they watch somebody else make that ultimate sacrifice. They sort of want to step in and do it for them, take care of their fellow soldier.
Pretty typical in that regards.
Yeah.
There was also a relationship that developed between a translator and the three women. Talk about that a little bit, because I think it tells us a lot about how they came from rural Indiana and related at a human level.
Right. So when they were traveling off post, Michelle and Deddy and the armament team worked with different translators, and after a little while they settled on this one translator who they just thought was by far the best. And it was a young man, Akbar Khan, and he was fluent not only in English and Dari and Pashto, but several other languages as well. He was college educated, really highly intelligent, and a great, great communicator. So they had so many questions for him. Like, you know, they'd be driving off post, they'd look out the windows of the vehicle, and Debbie would say, how come we don't see any girls over the age of 12? Like, I see all these young girls, And then there's just boys that are older. Where are the 14, 15-year-old girls? And he would explain, oh, well, culturally, it's not acceptable for older girls to be out of the house. They need to stay at home. They need to learn how to take care of the house for other people who live there. And it's just not seemly. It's not okay for them to be out and about, you know, in the way that, like, children might be out playing. And they would, you know, try and wrap their minds around this and think, well, it's not maybe the life I would choose, or not the life that I know or that I'm familiar with, but okay, that's really interesting. Glad somebody could explain it to us. They had so many questions. They also
he kind of became the window into Afghan culture for them, whether it was food or religion or customs.
Right. He tripled their understanding, quintupled it. They just learned so much from him. Yeah.
And it sounded like the reverse was a little true as well.
Right. He had a lot of questions for them. And often his questions were about religion. So sometimes, you know, he would, on a daily basis, take out a small prayer rug and pray at the right time. And then when they brought out a Christmas tree, the leader of their team, his wife, mailed a Christmas tree with ornaments and lights on it to sort of try and get them in the holiday spirit while they were so far from home. And the translator took one look at this tree and was like, why do you guys have a tree? What's that about? And they hemmed and hawed, and they like kind of struggled to try and explain why a tree, and they weren't really sure where the tree, they're like, it's just what we do. It's like, you guys don't know your own traditions? Why is it a tree? Like, you can't just say it's just what we do. You have to be able to explain it to me. So they are laughing about that.
And this relationship with the translator, Akbar Khan, which started while they were on deployment, continues on for many years afterwards as well.
It does. So when they're just getting ready to leave Afghanistan, he is about to marry his first cousin in an arranged marriage, and they are desperate to prevent this from happening because they feel he's unhappy about the idea that he doesn't want to do it, and they want him to come to America with them and sort of transform his life that way by living in the United States. And they really care about him, and they're worried about his well-being if he stays behind in Afghanistan where he's from. And they even try and see, will he marry Michelle instead? And there is sort of a little budding romance or flirtation between Michelle and Akbar, but they both realize that might not work very well, and they don't act on it. So they all go back to the U.S., and then after a while, they help him get a visa that will permit him to live and work in the U.S., and he does come here and try to make his way, but he winds up working at Home Depot and feeling that that's not very fulfilling. And he ultimately returns to Afghanistan.
Before we leave Afghanistan and turn to their second deployment in Iraq, I think we have to talk a little bit about, there are a lot of deployment friendships and lovers and harassment and other things going on, none of which seem to survive very long, and none of them really come home. Can you talk a little bit about how the women, in hindsight, looked at that phase of their life?
I will, and I have to say that I feel sometimes cautious about this subject, especially when I speak to anybody with military experience, because I felt very sensitive, and these women did have deployment relationships, and in some cases, they were with men who were married and had wives waiting for them at home. And I know that infidelity is a difficult subject under any circumstances, but in a deployment situation, even more so. And when they came back home, so Michelle, for example, she was besieged with attention from all the men on the post. She was only 21 during their deployment. She's young, attractive, long blonde hair, curvy figure, and the guys were just paying her quite a lot of attention. Always catcalls, whistles, hoots, and hollers. And to sort of stave it off and to try and have some peace and to stop everybody trying to crowd her at mealtimes, she settled on a boyfriend, and he was a married man. He has been pursuing her, and he explained to her that, in his view, his marriage wasn't working, and anyway, when they went back home, he then decided to end his marriage. He wanted to stay with Michelle. He and his wife had not been getting along for a long time. They did split up, and then the relationship with Michelle did not last, because once they were back home, the reasons for the relationship didn't hold true anymore. Michelle didn't need him in the same way that she had. And it wasn't as though, you know, she consciously had sought his protection on post, but that is the function that he served. In hindsight, she's clear that that's the role that he played for her, and she didn't need him to play that role anymore. And in fact, when she saw that back in Indiana, he was not always an upstanding guy, that he was selling drugs, that he wasn't behaving in ways that made her comfortable. Sometimes he was violent or angry. She was afraid he was going to hurt her. So she broke off the relationship. So he, you know, his marriage ended because he wanted to be with Michelle, but then Michelle did not want to be with him in the long run. And I think there's a lot of loss there, a lot of grief. And Michelle feels terrible guilt over parts of this, for sure, and has some big regrets.
I just want to let the listeners know that all of those subjects are dealt with in a very direct, intimate, maybe even raw way. So we're talking to Helen Thorpe, who wrote Soldier Girls, and she didn't whitewash any of this. This is pretty much put right out there, and everybody can draw their own conclusions. I don't want to get too stuck into that topic,
right,
because I want to move on to the second deployment, which comes three years later in 2008.
Yeah.
And at that time, Michelle has ended her enlistment, moved on to Colorado, going back to school, but Debbie and Desma find themselves again in deployed with the Indiana Army National Guard and heading to Iraq. Do they approach this much differently?
The second deployment was very different for a number of reasons. As you mentioned, it's 4 years later. Both war theaters have gotten way more violent. And Iraq was always, I think, a more difficult conflict from the U.S. point of view in terms of how things were going. So the violence in Iraq has escalated. The surge, you know, was the year before. The number of violent incidents, say IED blasts going off, that they had skyrocketed by 2007. And 2008, they were maybe starting to decline, but it still was a very, very violent year in terms of numbers of incidents. So it's scarier, darker, more difficult. And then on top of that, their unit was broken up and distributed across anywhere there was need in the rest of the brigade. So they did not deploy as a coherent unit. And that is what everybody in their unit found really, really hard. They were not with people they knew and trusted. They weren't with people that they had long history with. Desma, for example, was transferred into a previously all-male field artillery regiment, and she could serve in that regiment because they were being deployed in a support capacity. They were doing convoy security. But it's basically all men, Desma, one other woman, and she's there for a year in Iraq, and she's doing convoy security, which she's never done before, and she doesn't know any of these guys. So it's hard.
And this is a different deployment, too. Debbie, while she stays in headquarters working primarily,
yeah.
Desma's out driving a truck doing convoy work.
Way more
and
dangerous.
Desma,
yeah.
Way more dangerous. And she finds herself with an anger management problem.
She does. Yeah, she starts getting sent to anger management on a repeat basis by August of that year. I think they deployed in February. And it's been really hot for a really long time over there in Iraq. It's really, really dusty. There are dust storms. There's very few creature comforts. You know, she's sharing a two with Charity, the other woman in the unit, who has become her lover unexpectedly to everybody. You know, they buy a little TV because there's not much else to do. And Desna starts snapping at people. In one case, she's somebody else has borrowed the vehicle that she usually drives. They left it a real mess. It's full of, like, empty drink cans and candy wrappers, and it just looks like it's been on a road trip. And Desmond tells this kid that he needs to clean out the vehicle before she can use it, and he gives her a smart-ass answer, and she just knocks him upside the head with her Kevlar helmet. And, you know, this is not what how she's supposed to be behaving, and she is
unacceptable behavior.
Yeah,
although I think again,
all
the veterans listening can feel that they've probably been in that situation where the pressure builds and builds and builds, that's a bit of a difference between the first deployment and the second deployment. And we get to October of 2008. Desma's out driving, doing a convoy, and there's a roadside bomb. Tell us a little bit about what happens and what happens to her.
Sure. So at that point in time, Desma is driving in the assistant scout position, so she's second in the convoy. And the lead scout vehicle has pointed out that there is a box by the side of the road with silver metallic tape glinting in the sun on it, and it's, you know, sort of eye-catching, and it's out there, and they're not really sure what it signifies. Could be a bomb, might be nothing. It looks like the boxes that they recognize that the U.S. military is using, but who knows? And so their job is to check it out, and the lead scout vehicle tries, but they don't get close enough to see inside the box, which is open. If they could only get close enough, they could look in, they think. So the lead scout vehicle guy in the truck radios to Desma and says, can you get a little closer? Check and see what's in that box. Make sure it's okay for everybody to drive past it. So Desma, who's driving, you know, edges her vehicle, it's an ASV, over closer to the box. One tire wheel goes off the side of the highway just a little bit. She doesn't hit the box, but she does, in retrospect, it's clear, trip some sort of a wire. And the whole thing blows. And it's a big bomb, and she's right there, right next to the box, very close. And everybody in her truck is injured,
Yeah, and listeners, when you read Soldier Girls by Helen Thorpe, you're going to, again, quickly relate to her, you know, her concussion that she gets, the guilt that she feels. Ultimately, she's profiled with 30% headaches and vision and TBI, and ultimately that gets rolled up to I think 50% with PTSD.
Right.
These are all things we've talked about before on Veterans Radio, and I think our listeners will really get a good feel for that when they read your book.
Yeah,
we're getting close to the end.
You know what I wanted to show there also was what it's like for a mom to have those injuries and come home and try and parent again. And maybe you've talked about that too, because I'm used to speaking to civilian audiences. But for civilians, it's big news that there are single moms out there coming home with TBI. They just don't think of that as how things are. In their minds, soldiers have to be male. You know, the civilian population, they've not caught up yet with the new reality. And so it's a whole new idea that somebody like Desma comes home with those hallmark injuries. Sorry, I jumped in.
No, you painted a good picture in the book about the problems of parenting for her because of those injuries.
Yeah.
And that leads us to sort of some ending questions I wanted to get to, which is, who did you write this book for? What population were you trying to get to?
You know, I had in mind a reader who would be open-minded, not like prejudiced against the military or for it, not kind of having an ideological point of view like women should be in the military or shouldn't be in the military. I'm writing for somebody who's open-minded, likes to think about big questions, and is curious about the fact that there are more women in the military doing overseas deployments than ever before. What does that mean? What is it even like? What is it like for those women? And then I wanted to really paint a picture that was so detailed that that reader who might not know what it's like firsthand himself or herself, but's really curious, you know, that reader could sort of walk miles in the boots of these women and know more about what their service meant, what it felt like, and what it signified to these women, what it meant to them. And I think the women themselves that I was writing about, they had a different audience in mind, especially Desma. Desma's audience, in her mind, the reason she wanted to participate in this book, why she shared her therapy notes, she was thinking about the soldier who's afraid to ask for help. And she thought if she showed that she got help that was meaningful, that she went to therapy and it did something for her, helped her relax, find some peace of mind, that she could be an example, maybe, to somebody who is not sure that therapy will do anything. So they had different motivations, I think, than I did. But in the end, I know we're trying to write for, you know, trying to share their stories for both a military audience and a civilian one.
And Desma got a medical discharge, I think, in the end.
He did.
And Debbie ultimately retired from Army National Guard
close
after putting her
60,
time in.
She did. Yeah, she could see another deployment coming, and she didn't think at age 60 that she had the energy and will to do a third deployment. So she did reluctantly retire. She loved being in the Guard, and she misses it now.
I want to read a little section before we close out here. It's towards the very end of the book. It's probably the last paragraph, a few sentences in the last paragraph in the book, where you write, "In the 10 years that they had known one another, they had survived 2 wars, 2 deployments, 2 homecomings, 12 men, a lesbian affair, a lot of heartache, and many questions about the well-being of the 3 children who had gotten caught up in the evolving question of what role women should play in war," period, end of the quote. That's really the big question at the end there, isn't it?
Yeah.
What role should women play in war and parents who have to come back and parent those children with certain disabilities that they received during the war, isn't it?
Yeah. And in the afterword to the paperback, I discuss a little bit this idea of secondary PTSD, which I think family members can experience if they're living with somebody who has PTSD and it's ongoing and it's not getting better. And I think, you know, it's possible that Desma's children, to my mind, it seems like they might even be experiencing that secondary PTSD. And we're all learning more about that, and we're learning what soldiers can bring back home with them when they come home, and how the whole family has to heal.
Helen Thorpe, who author of Soldier Girls, tell us where folks can find this book, having listened to you and saying, hey, I want to read that. Where do they go find it?
Sure. They can find it on Amazon.com and most major booksellers, and there are links even on my website, which is just HelenThorpe.com.
And your publisher for this book,
yes,
want to give them a
yes.
Please give
them a
plug.
I love my publisher. They have done an incredible job. My editor talked to me on the phone on a monthly basis for 4 years while I worked on this project, and I'm eternally grateful. His name's Colin Harrison, and the publisher is Scribner.
Veteran radio listeners, we've come to the end of our time allotment. I want to tell you that this is a well-written, thoughtful book. At times you're going to feel it's a little too intimate. Maybe it's uncomfortable. Maybe it's a raw look at deployments, particularly from a woman's point of view. But I think that's good for us sometimes to be a little uncomfortable and think about some of the issues that are raised as a result of Helen Thorpe's writing of Soldier Girls. Thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone, and it's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.